It is Saturday, January 24th, 2009, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news and all about Adobe Lightroom. That's digital asset management on Geek Speak. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com. And it's time now, of course, for my favorite show on KOSP. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today on Geek Speak, we're covering the geek news, and in the second half, we're having Tom Hogarty join us. He's the senior product manager for Adobe Systems' professional digital imaging department. That means he manages RAW, the DNG format from Adobe, and also Lightroom. And we'll be talking a lot about Lightroom 2, which is a digital asset management system, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that means in about 20 minutes or so. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Al Luckow. He is a new media architect. Good morning, Al.
Good morning.
Miles Elam, student programmer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And we also have Ben Jaffe, and Ben Jaffe is a freelance media dude.
Good morning.
Morning. You know, I use dude because you're so young. I started the show by saying this is my favorite show on KOSP, but truthfully, I don't listen to it that often, so I don't know if it is.
I do.
You listen to it.
I listen back every week.
I'm supposed to listen to it every week. That's a rule of doing good
radio.
Don't
feel so bad, man. I never listen to you anyway.
I listen to it on the air, too. I listen to it live, and I listen to the podcast.
You don't listen to it live. You're always here.
He's got one of those things like on Harry Potter that Hermione had.
He's actually in the other room. He's in the room right now listening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I listen to it 9 seconds before most of our listeners hear it.
That's true. We have a digital delay. Yeah, I totally forgot about the digital delay. It always messes with me, and you leave the room, and you still hear yourself talking. It's creepy.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger. Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
Robot is dead.
That robot.
Yes.
From the Will Robinson show.
He's died. Bob May, who was the guy inside the robot, was a guy in there. He died.
Wait a second, there was a guy in there?
There was a guy. It was, yeah. And it's really sad. I mean, of course, that was his name, Robot. They didn't have, wasn't like Robbie the Robot or Frank the Robot was his name.
You seem a little upset that they just named it Robot.
Yeah, I mean.
It is hard to search for.
The creative director in there, I mean, come on.
Lazy.
Let's just call him Robot.
All right, so a little shout out to the guy that played Robot.
Danger, yeah. Will Robinson, danger.
So he's dead.
All right. I'm sorry to hear that, and we wish you well.
This is not the voice, though. This is...
Right.
Yeah, the voice sounds pretty digital.
It's the guy.
It's the guy. Yeah. With the short arms.
That's okay. Actually Microsoft Sam reading that, the digital voice in Windows 98.
I don't think that's a digital voice. I think that's a human.
I know. I was just joking.
All right,
but that'd be pretty, kind of funny because, you know, back then, the digital voicing was not very good.
What about the other kind of, like, digital robot in our world? What's it doing?
Like the one we all use called Google.
Yeah.
I think there was a story in the news where a guy was involved in a hit and run, and they never found the guy, and it killed the woman. But they had enough information to figure out, you know, who the guy might have been. They got a search warrant for his house, and there wasn't a lot of evidence there. But they did go through his computer and looked for his past searches. Of which were auto glass reporting requirements to law enforcement, auto glass, theft, hit and run.
So this is his Google search history prior to the police ever talking to him.
Right. And he said he was home and he never did anything. And they find actual hit and run searches that go directly to the incident that he was involved in.
Uh-huh.
So they ended up convicting him based on all the evidence that were.
Did they get a warrant to see that?
Yeah, they got a warrant because they found some hood ornament or something from this Jaguar that he was driving, and
they got enough to kind of think it was him, and they got enough to
and they went to his house to say, go for it. Of course, his car was all fixed up, out of state, and everything.
Oh, and that was one of his Google searches, right?
Yeah, how to fix a car out of state. You know, all this stuff. So watch what you're Googling. You know, I mean,
well, if you're doing crime activity,
yeah. But still, it's sort of interesting how they can just peer right into your life by looking at your Google searches.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Here's another suggestion: don't do crime. Don't
that too.
Never miles.
Well, I mean, hit and runs, not so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
By the way, I just looked it up. The robot did have a name. Robot B9.
Oh.
Wow. Oh, yeah, that's
some
right.
trivia.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's
It's true.
That's something. Okay.
That there's some creative horsepower behind that.
I guess. They really. Yeah.
Well, what should we name this robot? B1.
Yeah.
1? No, that's too unoriginal.
Yeah.
B2?
Big conferences, hours of meetings.
B9.
Miles, your news story. Thanks, Al. Go for it.
Network Solutions is the subject of a very large distributed denial of service attack, a DDoS. What this means is that there are a lot of different machines all accessing Network Solutions resources all at once and flooding their network. And unlike if you have a single machine, you try to send a whole bunch of requests to a particular site, they can see where that's coming from, just block that IP. When it's coming from a variety of different sites and they look like legitimate queries, what it does is bog down the network so that people who are legitimately making the query get a reduced service or no service at all.
Okay, so it's one of those things that hackers can do to take down a site. Right,
especially if they have a botnet.
Now, what's Network Solutions?
Network Solutions is a leading domain registrar, and they host currently 7.6 million domain names.
So like geekspeak.org would be a domain name, and somebody has to have that registered so that it comes to our machine.
They used to be the only one. I mean,
they used to be, yes.
Network Solutions was the first.
I would be delinquent in my duties as a spouse if I didn't say my wife hates Network Solutions with a passion because they're scum, something like that. But that's not me saying that. I'm just quoting someone. In any case, Network Solutions.
They are the 900-pound gorilla.
Yeah.
600-pound gorilla.
And they do some tactics that I don't like, in that when you need to transfer domain, they normally delay it. And then if you haven't triggered an okay to transfer to another domain site, they will put it on hold for 60 days. And if that's close to when your renewal time comes along, you've got to renew with them. So it's one of those things where, oh, I'm going to transfer this time around. I'm going to go to a different company. And it's within 60 days of your time. If you make any mistake at that point, they got you for another year.
The Network Solutions also is... Of registrars, I mean, they're all basically evil. There's one particular...
I disagree. I really like mine.
There's one that a scam that gets people all the time is you get a thing in the mail, a letter, that's from a registrar that says, hey, it's time for you to renew. And you say, oh, okay. And you open it up and some, you know, you just do it. But what you don't realize is that you just transferred your domain from...
A lot of companies do that. I know. The ones I like...
And
Miles,
you spend money
you use Joker, right? Joker.com. I use GKG.net. I really like that. They got a great bulk registration thing where you can look for a lot of domains at once. It's one of a web geek hobby is to look for new domains. Like when I messed up on Al's last name, he went and bought his domain.
Yeah.
Alternate spelling. In any case, okay, let's move on. But thank you for that information. Why are they doing it? Why are they denial of servicing Network Solutions? And does it affect the domain name service system?
It does for anyone who is trying to access a domain that is hosted by Network Solutions. Why they would do it? Network Solutions has, a fair number of enemies. But there's also a high potential for extortion. Right. This is why a lot of distributed denial of service attacks occur on the net, although I haven't seen many with regard to an infrastructure. It's mostly been towards e-commerce sites or online gambling sites, offshore gambling.
Okay. Thank you, Miles, for that. Well, I've got a little bit of a story that I'll go ahead and do because I rarely do them because I'm lazy. And that is that there's a Mac Trojan and a Trojan... A Trojan software package that's affecting Macintosh computers, and it's packaged into a pirated copy of Apple's iWork 09. So up on some BitTorrent.
Why is it called a Trojan?
I thought Trojans were supposed to protect you.
Okay. So what a Trojan is, it's very similar to the story of the Trojan horse, and that is that the people of Troy went ahead and let that horse into their gates. They breached all their security by bringing it inside, and as soon as they did that, they brought the enemy inside. They broke all their security themselves. Nobody else did it.
Because they thought it was a gift.
Because they thought it was something good. Mm-hmm. Right. So the idea of a Trojan software package on your computer is that you think you're getting something you want. You install this package, putting in your password, getting through all your security, and as soon as you've done that, you've actually installed something that you didn't really think you wanted, like criminals inside the horse. So the Trojan that just hit, the reason why I think it's kind of a big story is that 20,000 people have downloaded this this pirated copy of Apple's iWork 09, and that Trojan's actually in it, and it gets installed when you install the iWork 09. So now, you guys kind of, Al, you kind of argued with me about this, and Miles, you did too, that it's not a big deal. Can you give me that argument?
Well, it's...
The keyword is pirated.
It's also a question of scale. I'm not saying it's not a big deal, because it is, because 20,000 people have downloaded it. This is, if anything, a great advertisement for buy your software.
Right.
Get it pirated. But the reason why I downplayed it was because if you look at, for example, the recent Windows worm that was going around, that was from a vulnerability that Microsoft patched in October that people hadn't patched. That was an example of a worm. You don't have to do anything except have your computer on and it gets attacked. Whereas this, you have to actively go look for software, download it to your system, and run it yourself.
You have to look for pirated software on a pirate site, download it, and then enter in your administrative account, install it, and expect it to be...
Yeah, like basically no one listening right now is infected with this thing, has this Trojan, unless they went and installed iWork.
It's not taking advantage of an exploit in OS X or any software in OS X.
And because of that, unlike a worm, which is much nastier, it doesn't spread by itself. You have to have a lot of activity. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you, it's definitely less threatening than a worm. It's definitely less threatening than any kind of email-propagated virus of some sort, or a web page-propagated virus, which is really nasty as well. But the point is that somebody took the time and effort to go ahead and make an exploit to OS X and distribute it, and they successfully distributed it. Mm-hmm. That's the first time we've seen that on OS X. It's always been, you know, when people if people call and go, my computer's slow, and we say, are you on a Mac or a Windows? If they say Windows, we go, okay, you probably have to clean up your virus problems, right? There's probably something going on your machine. If you're on a Macintosh machine, we don't even come to that. We're like, okay, so it's probably something else. So now we have to go, well, did you pirate some software? I mean, it's just an interesting thing.
It is interesting. Right? It's not hard to do, though. I mean, you could just open up hard disk utility, you know, redo the UI, change the buttons around, and make it format your hard drive.
There's nothing clever about it.
There's nothing clever. I mean, the whole thing about viruses, you know, you got to, you know, do something really sneaky and clever, and there's nothing. I mean, you got to be complete doofus to get this virus.
All right.
Well, I
would disagree with that, but
you just have to be poor.
I think. I don't know.
You just have to be poor and want to be able to get some work.
Yeah, maybe you want to get away from Office and you want to try iWork, and this is your way of doing it. You pirate iWork 09, you say, oh, I like this or I don't, and if you like it, you buy it or something like that. I mean, if that's your reasoning, although you're still doing something illegal, you don't have malicious intent.
Don't download packages of software from BitTorrent sites and install them and assume that you're safe.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a good thing to do.
You're taking your chances, and there's the whole, you know, thrill of the hunt. So
and you know what? With regard to iWork, yes, it's a great program. It is, but there are alternatives
Open Office,
free, open source. Yeah, mm-hmm. Open Office 3. It's available. It's free. Try it, download it. If that doesn't work, then maybe you should be shelling out the money for iWork
or Word.
But why not try something that's free first?
Yeah, open and not.
And you won't get a Trojan.
Not copying it from illegally. Okay, let's go ahead and go on to what's going on at the White House. We got new presidents. I think since the last Geek Speak episode, we have new president, new White House. Everything's fun, and there's some tech stuff that's kind of cool.
It's pretty crazy. This article in the Washington Post puts it very humorously. It says, in many ways, the move into the White House resembled a first day at school. Advisors wandered the halls looking for their office. Aides spent hours in orientations. So it did not go entirely smoothly. A lot of people found themselves without phones, without email addresses. And so finally they resorted to giving White House staffers Gmail addresses. as opposed to getting the White House system to work because they haven't been able to. Also, you know,
so they got Gmail email instead of White House email.
Gmail email. That's kind of fun to say.
Is it normally that the email addresses are like whitehouse.gov?
At whitehouse.gov, yeah.
Interesting, because, of course, one of the things that happened right away on Inauguration Day, I believe, is that change.gov, which had been Obama's kind of they're planning and stuff website, switched over to be whitehouse.gov.
Well, kind of course, it's actually a different website, but it has a lot of the same similarities, but basically the old whitehouse.gov
and the new whitehouse.gov changed, and
that involved
probably a DNS switchover,
yeah,
which would have affected email if you did it wrong. So
that's true. So
that
might
have been the reason. Anyway, they made Gmail accounts. It's so funny because 4 or 5 years ago, I had a student or an employee at UCSC, and I wanted them to have an email address so I could communicate with them the first day. And after filling out the form and realizing it's going to be like a week and a half before they got an email address at UCSC, mm-hmm. I sent an invite from Gmail, which at that point was, you know, Google's mail client was invite only. She had an email that I authorized within 10 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever.
Yeah.
So I can see why they did that. What are the email addresses?
They're wh.their last name@gmail.com.
All right.
So and then also the other thing with the new website actually is the robot.txt file is way, way shorter. So what a robot.txt file is, you have these like you have Google and Yahoo crawling the web and looking for things to catalog for their search results. And if you go to that spider, they call it, goes to a website, it reads this thing called robot.txt, which tells it all of the places it should not index.
Okay, wait, let me summarize.
Yes.
There's a file on every website called robot.txt, a robot mm-hmm. text file, and it just lists a whole bunch of URLs that search engines are not supposed to go to.
It can also say URLs that you are supposed to go to.
Right.
It can also be
it's
a whitelist.
It's information
as well.
So
That's
that
true.
The Google search engine, the Yahoo search engine, all those things that actually crawl your site and figure things out, have more information about what they should and shouldn't
do on
their site.
And they can do it more effectively,
okay.
too.
So the old robot file versus the new robot file at whitehouse.gov?
The old robot file was almost 2,400 lines of disallowing, and the new robot.txt file was one line.
What's the one line say?
That was yesterday. /includes/. And then today it's 3 lines. And this isn't necessarily a good thing. I mean, it's certainly
3 lines in 4 days. That's not a very good rate.
No. They added 2 lines. They changed from 1 line to 3 lines.
All right. Anyway, so a little bit more open. It's kind of
it kind of symbolizes transparency.
Right.
But
cool.
in reality, maybe it's not entirely the best. I mean, it's good, but robot.txt exists for a reason. It's not just to keep data from search engines.
So anything else about the White House that's kind of exciting technology wise?
There's a lot of news, but I'm not going to cover any more. But
okay,
you know,
we'll move on.
Do Google searches. It's pretty cool.
Al, you got any new gadgets this week?
You know, there was something interesting. You know, I'm not sure you can actually buy it, but it's called Lightlane, and somebody's come up with the idea of putting a laser on your seat of your bicycle that actually projects a light lane around you,
a bike lane
around you. So you have the lines on the left and the right, and then I think it says bike and lane, you know, and as you ride your bike around, you've got this like laser
projection
around you.
Around you. Is this for you or for other people? What's it for?
It's because it's a cool thing, I think, more than anything else. Uh-huh. But it is pretty a neat idea, and I've talked to some people that said that this is entirely possible, and I've seen pictures of it, but you know, I mean,
the basic idea is like a bicyclist when they're playing with cars will get really close to people, mm-hmm. and they kind of invade the space. The bicycle needs a little bit of maneuverability space. It needs a lane of area.
Yeah, anytime you have a light on a bike or something blinking,
so this is
just
kind of helping to say,
right,
this is my space, stay away from me. Yeah,
which totally is, it's kind of a neat thing though. Yeah. I mean, just imagine it, you know,
bring any more awareness to bicyclists is a good thing.
Yeah,
definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Miles, I think we're going to close up the news with you. What's going on Mars?
Yes, out in the final frontier, there's been some findings by the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter using SHARAD, shallow radar, to test the composition of the North Pole of Mars. Now, what's so interesting about that? Well, when they looked at the South Pole, they thought that it was mostly frozen carbon dioxide, dry ice.
Mm-hmm.
And then they found, oh, there's actually some water there. It's carbon dioxide and water ice. So they started to take a look at the North Pole and see what they found there. As it turns out, they found what looks like 95% pure water ice
Wow.
on the North Pole. And it comes out to be 2 to 3 million cubic kilometers of it.
Ah.
To put that into context, that's about 100 times the volume of the Great Lakes.
Is this surface or undersurface?
It's mostly undersurface, just under a it's mixed in with layers of dust.
It would sublime too quickly if it was on the surface.
Sublimate, yeah.
Sublimate. Very cool. Okay, so lots of water on Mars.
Right.
Awesome.
Which
last week we talked about lots of carbon.
Lots of gas.
Lots of gas that could be
methane.
Life,
yeah.
Methane gas. Okay, go on.
And so this could also mean for when we send people out there, when we send long-term probes or something like that, that we can...
They can get drinks.
Right. Well, you can get...
you
have a water supply.
It's
if you hike
dry.
To the North Pole, right?
Yeah, if you go up to the North Pole and you need a drink, there's ice.
So we've got useful. Horses drinking the water and making the methane on
Mars?
Must
be. It must be.
Martian. Invisible
life
Martian
on Mars.
It's really eating the water because it's not going to be liquid. Well, thank you very much for that cool news, for all the news. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The Geeks doing the news. Miles Elam, Al Luckow. Man, I messed up again.
It's okay.
I get scared
I'm
now.
That's sensitive.
Ben Jaffe. Ben Jaffe. And our guest today is Tom Hogarty. Tom is the Senior Product Manager for Adobe Systems' Professional Digital Imaging Department. His primary product and marketing responsibilities center around Adobe Photoshop Lightroom, which is a digital asset management system. Also, Camera Raw and the DNG file format, which is Adobe's Camera Raw format. Prior to joining Adobe, Hogarty worked in New York as a consultant to many of the industry's leading professional photographers as they converted from film to a digital workflow. Tom, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Wow, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being there. You've actually been listening to the news the whole time, and you didn't chime in, but you, of course, would have been welcome. I've been reading up a bit about you. You're definitely a geek and a photographer.
Yeah, actually, I was busy searching to find out when my domain name expired.
Don't go to Network Solutions. So, Tom, explain what a digital asset management is.
Well, digital asset management is a pretty commonly used phrase for technology folks. Managing different kinds of digital media, whether it's video or film or images or documents. It's just a way to manage your creative assets.
So it's like the shoebox of digital photographs.
Right. You know, one of the things, I actually don't like that phrase, digital asset manager.
Really? Why not? Because it just sounds too offensive?
Well, since I work with photographers...
it spells damn.
Someone, when they're growing up, when they see their first Robert Capa image, they don't say, wow, I want to learn digital asset management.
Okay.
Learn photography.
Okay. So explain what Lightroom does for you on a computer. What are the generalities that it does?
Well, the quick and dirty is it's basically like having a digital assistant. There's a lot of administrative and file management things you need to do with your digital captures in terms of getting them off the camera, bringing them onto your local hard drive, kind of sorting through and picking out the best ones. And I would say, a decade ago, I had to cobble together 12 or 13 applications to do that. What Lightroom does is consolidate all those operations in kind of a nice, easy-to-use format and layout so you can, get past the what I call the administratia and get to the good part, which is working with your images.
So it basically is a giant system it's an application that will manage all of your photographs. I mean, I currently think I have about 60,000 photographs. A lot of them are on the last year about is on my laptop. The rest of them are on an external hard drive. Lightroom allows me to, even without the external hard drive, scan through, find files, look at them, and then if I want to edit the older ones, we've got to plug in the external hard drive, but it then registers, sees that, and allows me to play with all my photographs in one place. I can then export them to different formats. So it's basically managing my photos. That's the major goal or the major use of the application is managing photographs.
Yep. And helping you share them as well. So
yeah.
That's important.
All right. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We have Tom Hogarty. Is it Hogarty?
Hogarty.
Tom Hogarty from Adobe. He is an expert on Lightroom, knows all about it, and also about photography. And we're taking calls about digital photography, about managing photos on your computer, anything in that realm. That's the kind of calls we're taking today. I'm inviting people right now to call and ask questions. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Every Saturday right after Geek Speak at 11 and Sunday morning at 9 right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to KUSP. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. We have Al Luckow, Ben Jaffe, Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. And, of course, we also have Tom Hogarty. And Tom is an expert on all things digital photography on the computer. And actually, we can probably talk about cameras, too. Please feel free to call us about those topics right now. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-KUSP. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. Tom, I've been using Lightroom since I think your beta came out in the labs area. And in Lightroom 2, some of the features that I kind of like is the interface to, like, one of the things I love is the recrop tool now allows you to do lens correction after cropping. Tell me what lens correction is. Can you hear me there still? Tom?
Can you hear you?
Yeah, hello. Tom, you're kind of cutting out.
Okay.
Now I can hear you. Go for it.
This one lens correction specifically is about vignetting. And in the corner of the images, it can get darker or lighter depending on what kind of lens you're using. So we had a lens correction to correct for that prior to Lightroom 2. But we talked to a lot of photographers who said, you know, I use this not only for correcting the lens, but actually for creating an artistic effect.
Stylizing, yes.
So what we needed to do was actually add the ability to, apply that effect even after you had cropped. So it's not really a lens correction anymore. It's a stylistic effect. And I got to say that was probably one of the most popular additions.
Yeah, for me as well. What we're talking about is if you see an old photograph of, like, you know, your grandparents or something, you'll normally see them standing in the yard with really nice clothes on, because that's what people used to do. And the photo itself is fine. You know, it's normally kind of washed out. But around the outside of the photograph, it's very dark. The corners are kind of dark. And the reason for that has to do with lens aberration. The lens can't pick up light the same way, and it causes the actual exposure on the negative to be dark around the edges. Digital cameras will do that too, depending on the kind of lens. If you have a real high telephoto, will happen, and different kinds of lens will actually cause that effect. And you need to compensate for that digitally by allowing somebody to add or darken the outside, and depending on the lens, it changes the shape. But if you want to make a photo look cool from any point and click, all you have to do is kind of add that darkening around the outside, and all of a sudden the photograph looks like an older print, which brings back this nostalgia for photography that we all actually will notice, even if we're not really aware we're noticing it. So that's why I guess it was kind of a popular thing. And what I'm talking about, the new Lightroom, when you crop a photograph, what you're talking about is you're recutting what the actual framing of the photograph is. You remove some of the photograph. Then if the vignetting or the lens correction didn't work, worked only in the original file, which it did in Lightroom, you wouldn't be able to do that cool effect. So anyway, yeah, I like that feature. Some of the other features, you seem to be increasing speed and bugginess. It's less buggy. But one thing I do want to know, because I use Lightroom quite a bit, as you can tell, do you have the ability to make scripts and plugins and stuff for Lightroom, like for the ability for me to sync my Lightroom stuff with Flickr?
Absolutely. So we focused on a couple different APIs, application programmer interface. I guess the listeners of this show would understand that, for Lightroom 2. And, you know, probably the primary one that most people use is what's called the export plugin. So you can take your image selection out of Lightroom. You've got maybe 10 or 15 images you want to share, and use a plugin, this export plugin, to connect directly to a web service like Flickr, Zenfolio, SmugMug. Those are some of the more popular ones. And so by developing this API, we basically turn it over to the community and let them build the connection to the various external services.
What have you seen that works well?
Probably Flickr is the most popular one. That will take your images directly up to Flickr, put them in the right photo set, add the right tags. That definitely is a popular...
Will it also let Lightroom know which ones have been uploaded so that you don't do it again?
Right, and that's the actual second part of the API that we introduced with Lightroom 2. It's the metadata API. So you can have custom metadata associated with your images, not just the standard, what was the ISO, what was the shutter speed. So custom metadata can be applied on the way up to Flickr to say, hey, I uploaded this file to Flickr.
All right. Let's go ahead and go to Santa Cruz. Peter, welcome to GeekSpeak.
How's it going?
Good. What's your question today?
Good. I've been using Lightroom for a while here, and I've sort of filled up my internal hard drive, and I've transferred everything over to an external hard drive so that I have more room because it's, you know, it keeps asking me to for more disk space in order to run the next batch of images. Mm-hmm. And my question is how much information, how much space does Lightroom use per image for the images that it keeps, even if I'm storing the main file offboard on a separate drive, it's still using a certain amount of space on the drive that has Lightroom installed on it to
right,
store.
So okay, we got that, Peter.
10,000 images, how many does it use?
That's a good question. Okay, Tom, you want to hit that?
Yeah, absolutely. So what happens is, since Lightroom is a cataloging application, we store a reference to every file that you're working with. So even if that hard drive isn't attached, we can still see a kind of a preview image of what it does look like. And that's typically about 10%, 10 to 15% of the original asset size. So, you know, if you have 100 gigs of photos, you're probably going to end up using about, 10 to 15 gigs of disk space to store those references.
Is this when we're talking about, like, when I have offline, sometimes I've got, like, a very small thumbnail, but sometimes I've got kind of a screen size picture of the file, even though the file's not on my machine. That's what you're talking about, that library kind of cache of the image.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, go on.
You know, it is flexible. You can actually move that catalog and that cache off to another drive if you don't want to have it on your main computer.
Where do you change those settings?
By default, we just put the catalog directly in the pictures or my photos directory, depending on which platform you're on.
So you can move the whole catalog folder onto the drive with the photos, for example.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So you
can also erase the previews, right? You can erase, like, you've got a one-to-one type preview you can generate for a photo, and those would be, of course, larger?
Those are much larger. So by default, we get rid of those after about 7 to 14 days.
Okay. All right. Cool. Does that answer your question, Peter?
Yeah, that helps. I have a slightly related question.
Go for it.
I have sort of combed through the drive, my internal hard drive, looking for items that are taking up extra space that need to be deleted or that could be stored over onto these external hard drives, and it sure seems like I've filled the drive, and I've gone through and found almost everything that I can find that seems to be stored data, and yet there still seems to be some large cache of data stored there somewhere that's taken up a heck of a lot of space, and I can't really find it. Is there a methodical way to go through there and figure out what's taking up so much room on my drive?
Well, I think that's a general question. In Lightroom, what he's saying, what Tom's saying is that it's really in one place. It's with the catalog. There's a catalog, and then there's a cache of some sort as well. And so we lost Tom, so I'll get him back on. But so all the Lightroom stuff is right there. Of course, your computer itself can be dealing with paging system. Are you in a Mac or Windows machine?
Yes, a Mac.
Yeah, Mac. I would make sure to run the nightly. Ben, do you know how to run the nightly cleanup? Run the nightly cleanup?
I don't know if that'll help as much. If you, it's likely that you have a very large file or a set of very large files that just aren't being accounted for somewhere on your drive.
Yeah. Right.
And there's some freeware applications that'll do that. One of them is called WhatSize. The one I really, really love, it's really an incredible program called Disk Inventory X, and we'll put a link up on the GeekSpeak
and
website.
And I like JDisk. It's a little Java application, does the same
thing.
Oh,
I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, JDisk. I'll put JDisk up. Yeah. So there you go. Thank you so much for the call, Peter.
JDisk and what was it, JDisk?
Well, you know what? We'll put it up on geekspeak.org in about 10 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, let's go ahead and go to Los Gatos. Ed, welcome to GeekSpeak. Ed.
Hi. The last caller had a nice lead into my question. Instead of asking a totally digital question, this is digitally related. I've been gathering a lot of digital photo files that I'm starting to work on and learn the software. And my problem has become backups.
Yeah.
The old days, I've been getting used to DVD backups.
Right.
And that's just too slow.
You can't do it. Yeah, it's not, they're not large enough.
And so I asked around a bunch of stores, and I looked at the post-Christmas sales. And I managed to get at a ridiculously low prices, 75% off three half a gig hard disks.
Yeah, they're cheap. They're like under $200 now. Yeah.
So that I take one off site. So my question just is, what is the best way of backing files up now when you want to have a backup on site and a backup off site?
Okay. Tom, do you want to handle this? Or do you want us to take it?
Well, I can give you my own personal opinion on this. I think you've definitely got the right mindset. You basically, when you buy a hard drive, you don't buy one, you buy two or three, and you for the redundancy. And two, you can have two on site that are redundant, and the third gives you the redundancy in an off-site location, which is great. Now, me personally, I do that philosophy with three drives. I have many terabyte drives, and I just use SuperDuper to duplicate the drives bit for bit.
That's a Macintosh application that mirrors what you have in certain folders or the entire drive onto another drive.
Uh-huh. Yep, that's it.
And it's a great way to go. The one thing that's really nice about the SuperDuper idea about it is that you're actually copying your entire hard drive to another drive. So if your hard drive fails, you just plug in the other one and boot off of it, and your system works again. Ben showed me this trick a couple years ago, and I love it. So SuperDuper is a good one. There's also Carbon Copy Cloner, which is another option.
That one's free.
And there's a few of these same types of things on a Windows. But I don't do that anymore. I was doing that for a while, but I don't do that anymore. What I'm doing now, just to answer your question, Ed, I figure might as well, is I'm on a Mac, and so I'm using Time Machine's auto backup. So anything on my laptop, there's actually a copy of, and there's actually copies going back in time, depending on the size of my drive. And that takes care of the immediacy of making sure I've got a duplication. I then also, all my photos go into one folder, and I have Lightroom rename them into month folders, and then I take those and manually copy them over to a network attack storage RAID, and then also on my wife's computer so she can also look at the photographs, and also on a copy, another hard drive that I've got. So I have four copies, something like that, of all my photographs at any one time, or almost at any one time. So that's kind of what I'm doing. So it's kind of, you got to figure out a workflow that you can live with that's doable. And the one concern I'd have about the multiple drives is that how religious will you, how dogmatic will you be about it? How will you, every day will you make sure to do it? And so one thing I like about Time Machine is that I plug it in and it starts doing it for me. I don't have to think about it. So there you go, Ed. I hope that helps.
A lot, yeah. I'll look for those software packages.
Great.
Thank you very much.
We can put some links up to those too, right, Ben?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks, Ed, for the call.
I think the key with that question is making sure it is automated and it's running on a schedule. Because if you leave it up to your memory to say, well, I promise I'll do it every Friday to run this backup, then you probably won't.
Right. You got to do it whenever it's running.
Yep.
Yeah. I use ChronoSync.
What's ChronoSync?
It's just a little application. I mean, you don't need massive amounts of firepower to back up. Just have it back up changed files. And your idea, Lyle, of network attached storage, I mean, that really is the way to go. I mean, that's how everything is, I think, going to be in a year or two. Everybody's going to have that. Just a drive that connects to your network that doesn't have to be connected to the computer, but just connected into the network itself, and then you see it no matter what computer you're using. It's just going to be your home, a home base, and then it'll be like a RAID, duplicate.
Yeah.
LaCie has a really cool one right now, I noticed. And they're just coming down in price. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And the one trick with those I've always been concerned about is that, you're buying this kind of home product. It's got this kind of unknown to you RAID inside of it. The geeks will know that it's actually probably a RAID 5, which means you can lose one disk. It's not a problem. But the actual hardware package, if that hardware system fails, then you've got these drives that are set up in a RAID configuration, and that's your weak point, right? Your power supply for that thing dies, whatever. And the thing that the geeks have is happens to be me and Miles and Sean all have the same type of RAID. So if one of our systems dies, we can swap it out. I think, Miles, you've got some data on your NAS the NAS is dead, right?
Or do you have it running? The NAS is currently dead. I probably could play around with it, but yeah, I have it on just a single hard drive now.
Oh,
it's over RAID, so.
Okay. Because I, of course, can help you get that stuff off there. Anyway, we've got a call from, let's see, where were we? You guys are chatting so much in our chat window that I can't keep track. Okay, we got from Santa Barbara. Sylvia, welcome to Geek Speak. Hi.
Thank you.
What's your question, Sylvia?
Well, my question is actually, I'm getting into birding, and I'm just wondering, you said something about someone's there that can answer a question about cameras.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And I'm just wondering if it's the camera or the telephoto lens that gets you the great bird picture.
Tom?
Or both. And if so, what kind of camera do I need? What kind of telephoto lens do
okay.
I need?
I was going to say, yeah, it's definitely a combination of the two. And it depends on what you want to do with the images, but I would say you want a camera that has a fast shutter speed, so those specs are easy to find.
Now, when you say shutter speed, so that you can capture the bird in flight quickly, or do you mean release speed, so shutter trigger speed?
Well, I would say so you can, you know, capture the bird in flight or, you know, 1/1000th, 1/2000th of a second.
Okay.
You know, megapixels, that's, I don't think that really matters anymore.
Okay.
As long as you're over 8, you're probably fine. The lens, now that's an important decision. You're probably looking at least a 2 to a 400 millimeter lens. You know, you don't need to have a super low light lens that's measured by the aperture of the lens.
Unless you're taking pictures of owls, which are at night.
This is true.
Yeah, so what we're talking about is daytime pictures. You normally have a lot of light, which means that the important aspect of it is really your length of the focal point, which means how far away is it zooming in. It's kind of the zoom is the term that we all use normally. In any case, that's what you're talking about. But the more millimeters of zoom, if you will, the more expensive the lens is. And I guess I'm going to kind of say the standard photography thing, it's the glass. It's all about the glass. And that means the lens is a very important aspect of what you're doing. That's why those point and clicks just will not do it for you. So you're looking for, I mean, the geeks here in the chat are kind of talking like Canon or a Nikon camera, and then you're looking for a single lens reflex or an SLR camera. Tom, got a recommendation on them? You're probably playing with the most recent cameras, right? What do you like?
Well, all the latest cameras are really high quality. I do have the benefit of working with some of the latest models, and it's phenomenal, the quality that comes out of them. So yeah, I do agree. It really is about the glass, but it's also about you know, the equipment that goes with it in terms of being able to hold that lens for a good period of time. So there's some monopods or some tripods you might want to look at as well.
And Alex is saying that if you're going to get a big zoomed lens, you might want image stabilization in the lens. And that basically is the more of a throw of the lens, the more zoom, if you will, the easier it is.
What is that called?
Image stabilization. The basic idea is that if you're looking at something a long ways away and you're kind of zoomed in, like a telescope kind of quality, any kind of vibration, like your heartbeat or whatever, or just your hands, is going to cause the image to move around a lot, which means you're going to get a blurrier picture. And so image stabilization basically says, you know what, the camera itself will compensate for this by modifying one of the lenses to keep the image stable. It's a very cool effect. It doesn't work very well when you're panning in a video camera, but it's great for still photography. It takes more battery life from your camera, but that's about it on the negative side. And of course, it's expensive. So you could easily spend $6,000 to get a setup to be really on top of it. So tell us what your price is. We'll go down from there.
Well, I was hoping I could get something $2,000.
Okay, so right. I would go with a Nikon, the prosumer Nikon or a prosumer Canon, and get a 200 millimeter lens. You might be able to get that. What do you think, Tom? You think that's around that price?
Yeah, I think you can f4 200 millimeter lens, and if you say that at any camera store, they'll understand. With one of the Nikon D series, like a D90 or a D70, even for a reasonable price.
And let me tell you,
D90 you can take video with HD video too, which I like.
Sure.
You're holding a D90.
I have one
right
with me.
Now.
Yeah.
And so, Sylvia, let me just say that the magic thing when buying a camera is to go to dpreview.com. That's digitalphotographyreview.com or dpreview.com. They review all the newest cameras. They've got great comparison side to side. They even list right like some of the prices you can get them online. And then, of course, if you've got a good, I don't know Santa Barbara very well, but if you've got a really good camera shop, it is wonderful to go into a good camera shop because these people have played with the cameras. You can play with them. There's a great one in Palo Alto that I use up here, but from Santa Barbara, I wouldn't go up to Palo Alto. It's too far to drive.
Well, I'm actually on my way up to the Bay Area, so if you tell me the name of the one in Palo Alto.
Sure. I won't spell it for you, but I'll tell you the name. It's called Keeble and Shuckett. And maybe one of us can find the URL.
That's where I got my camera.
Of course, that's where everybody gets their cameras around here. Keeble and Shuckett is a great place. They've been around for a long time. They're kind of in the older downtown of Palo Alto. I don't know the address and everything, but if you go to our website, geekspeak.org, one of us will find the store.
There's two of them actually. They're right across the street from each other.
Yeah, and they do different focuses. So I would recommend going in there if you're in this area. It's a great store. Thanks so much for the call. Thanks, Sylvia.
Thank you so much.
So, Tom, I know we haven't covered nearly as many of the features, but I did want to talk about cameras, so I'm glad that Sylvia called. You just released a patch for a new RAW version, camera RAW converter thing, and you also released a new thing for Lightroom, a new update. Can you run through what you fixed or changed?
Yeah, well, so we do these updates regularly for Lightroom and the camera RAW plugin, and one of the reasons is as new cameras come out that capture this RAW format, the RAW format is just this information that's right off the sensor. It's not a JPEG file or TIFF file. When they release these new cameras, each RAW format is essentially a different new proprietary format that we have to interpret. So we need to update the application so they can read those files. So the big one is the Nikon D3X camera that was recently released. We added support for that RAW file format. We also found a few bugs in Lightroom 2.2. There was a memory leak that we addressed. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we fix these things and we add this new support, and then we pop it up on Adobe Labs. You were talking to Brian Hughes about that last week. It's kind of where we can have the community give us feedback on this release, make sure everything's all set, and then we'll do a final release. So
when the community gives you feedback, is that feedback public, or do you guys get it directly and then kind of go from there?
We get feedback in every manner possible. Okay. There's no end.
Because I want to go ahead and update my copy to the latest version, but I also don't want to go through the process of having two copies and making sure my library doesn't get modified. I'm nervous, so I'd like to see some success stories on doing it before I start playing with it. So do you guys publish that stuff, or do you kind of wait? The labs is really for playing, and then when you are done, you'll release it more publicly?
Well, the public discussions, you can find them on the Adobe user forums, where people download, they talk to each other about their experiences, and the experiences so far have been really positive. If we're doing something where you want to be a little bit more cautious, we call those betas. That means we're experimenting, and we want feedback on how features are implemented, and we're going to change things and break things, and we're telling you this is a public beta. We want your feedback, but don't rely on it for day-to-day. There's another different kind of public release we do. It's called a release candidate, and that's more of a, this is really solid, but we just want to make sure before we finalize that you guys have a chance to play with it. So betas, a little bit riskier, but more fun and more ability to influence the product. Release candidates are, we're about to ship this next update. We just want to give it to you for a few weeks to get your feedback.
So do you use Lightroom? Are you taking a lot of pictures?
Oh, I do take a lot of pictures, and I do use Lightroom.
And how much are you opening Photoshop at this point? I find that I use Photoshop a lot less.
Well, my general rule of thumb is if it's going up on my wall, I'm going to open it up in Photoshop and do the touch-ups there. And, that's really maybe one out of 2,000 frames.
Right.
Which, makes sense because, Photoshop 18 years ago, one out of 2,000 frames is about how many images made it off the light table and were scanned onto a computer. So,
right.
It's really good at the finished work, the polish, the detail, the really advanced high-touch stuff. For pros, it's I call it the images you're getting paid for.
Right.
You want to bring those into Photoshop. Everything else I can generally get done in Lightroom. So it's a nice kind of symbiotic relationship.
Where are your photos online? Do you have a Flickr or a SmugMug or something?
I have a private site.
You do have a private site. Okay. Now, I got a question for you about film to digital. It seems to me that most people that I talk to about digital also have a collection, whether it be theirs or somebody else's negatives or slides. Is there a process is Lightroom the right tool for like importing and managing that flow of going from the film scan into a system? Like can it recognize anything on the negative framing when you scan it that will help categorize it and figure out what it is?
No, unfortunately, there's really no method for passive categorization, that's what I call it, of film scans. You don't have that exit information about the date, the time, or any of the GPS information you might get today. So it is a somewhat manual process, and you might want to be more selective about what scans, what images you bring from film to digital, because there is some overhead. And it's not just about scanning. I've actually talked to some photographers who created mounts for their digital cameras, and they just actually, with a special light setup, just pass the frames in front of the lens, do a digital capture.
Mm.
So they to go through that process of scanning.
So using their camera on like a macro and just hit it because it's fast.
It's kind of like a camera copy stand.
Yeah. And the thing that's nice about that is then if you're actually going to reprint the photo, you can just print it from the film.
Yep.
Yeah.
Hey, Tom, I have a question. With this new Lightroom 2, you said, you open up the SDK for developers for third-party plugins. Have you seen any cool plugins? I mean, I'm kind of a plugin guy. I like that kind of stuff. I'm just wondering what is out there right now, aside from, uploading to Facebook, for Lightroom 2.
Well, let me create a quick distinction, because when people hear the name Photoshop and they hear the word plugin, immediately what springs to mind is, you know, this cool thing that's going to take my image and warp it or apply a filter effect or right. actually change pixels. And the goal of the Lightroom API is to extend kind of the workflow.
Okay.
So we don't actually have an image processing API for plugins.
Huh.
So everything's around metadata, workflow, connecting to other applications, connecting to other websites and services, different kind of web galleries. So it's very much a workflow API instead of an image processing API.
Do you have a feature that will allow you to generate your own catalog of photos on your own site? So say, you know, how Photoshop has that web gallery, Flash web gallery thing, and you can put music in it. Do you have anything like that? I mean, is that the kind of thing that is added on? Or
That's actually built in by default. And so what we did with Lightroom 1 is we released this as part of the application, a web module. And you've got Flash and HTML gallery templates, and you bring your images in. And the cool thing is you can actually see exactly what it's going to look like before you upload it. So you kind of say, I want the background color to be black, and I want my...
Tom, I want to kind of critique that. I mean, it is a great... I mean, it definitely works, but the templates don't seem to be modifiable. I've been trying to change them. It seems to be that they don't have a lot of metadata output in the built-in templates. What's going on with that? Do you guys have more... For the web module, do you have a way to enhance it and change it so that you have better online cataloging?
So that is something we released for Lightroom 2, which is the web API.
Cool.
So now developers can go in and create their own web templates load them right into Lightroom.
It seems like it's ripe for third parties to, you know, come up with the Lightroom web gallery templates.
Yeah,
you know,
really
it's,
good
it's
ones.
It's just a really that kind of a business is really it's on the horizon, I guess.
We're running out of time on the show, but I want to say, are you going to have a facial recognition thing built into Lightroom soon?
That's definitely a possibility. We're looking at that technology. It's just a matter of what our customer base needs.
Well, thank you, Tom, for joining us on GeekSpeak. Tom Hogarty works for Adobe. You can learn more information, of course, and kind of see what's going on behind the scenes at labs.adobe.com. If you've got a question you didn't get answered, please feel free to ask us online, and I'll pester Tom to help answer it if we don't know how. Tom, thank you so much for being on GeekSpeak today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. Broadcasting in HD radio on 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH in San Ardo, or on the web at kosp.org. Car Talk on KOSP is made possible by a grant from Holly Family Fund at the Community Foundation of Santa Cruz County, and we appreciate the support. I mention that because Car Talk is coming up next. For KOSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. The geeks today were Miles Elam, Al Luckow, Ben Jaffe, and answering the phones was Rick. Thank you all very much for being here today on GeekSpeak.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Goodbye.
Until next week.